of those who worked in the 60s and their position now in relationship to the people's movement of the 80s. But ostracism just yet in America has not reached that point. At this point, we want to encourage everyone to join an organization, any organization. And that's why we repeat, if you're not in our party, NAACP, Urban League, anything. So when we see somebody, well, I work with the NAA, we pass you by. Well, I don't join the NAA because they ain't saying nothing, they just reactionary, they bunch of Uncle Toms. Well, what organization you with? Well, what organization you with? Well, this NAACP people is advanced over you because they ain't organization, you're not. So our line is a hard line on this question of organization. Any organization. And we are so badly organized that the axiom we say is a correct axiom. Bad organization is better than no organization at all. So for us right now, it's not how you struggle, it's that you struggle. It's a question of constant political education. In the first place, the Africans born in America learned from the Africans born in the Caribbean from the enemy. And the Africans born in the Caribbean learn about the Africans born in America from the enemy. And the job of the enemy is to heighten the dissimilarities to keep us apart. Consequently, it is our task, if you want them to organize, it's very simple, it's a scientific process. Everything is similar and at the same time dissimilar, everything. You and I, we're similar. We are men, in that respect, equal in every aspect. But while meaning men, we're different. You're a woman, and I'm a man. Different form, different shape. But we're equal in every aspect. So everything is the same and not the same. Every culture has similarities and dissimilarities. African cultures throughout the world have similarities and dissimilarities. But because of imperialism, the dissimilarities are only shown, and the similarities are hidden. It is our job to bring out the similarities, and the similarities outweigh the dissimilarities. Once we bring out the similarities, we begin to see the basis for unity. You understand it? So it's a scientific process. Just begin to find the similarities between brothers and sisters born in the Caribbean and brothers and sisters born in America and advocate those similarities which are direct, so we begin to see it and the process will begin to come. So from your propaganda, all you have to do is list about 18 things which are similar, show similarities, and then every day put out one, next week put out another one, next week put out another one. See how interesting life can be when you work for the people?
where is the land that belongs to the Jewish people?
I have one slight problem here with the way you pose the question. You call the people a Jewish people. I consider Judaism to be a religion, not a nationalism. So it's difficult for me to answer that question.
I'm not a believer in Judaism, but I am a Jew, so
where is my land? Well, that's where the problem is. I do not think, of course, it's difficult, but based on my understanding of the history of Judaism, I do not think that someone can be a Jew unless they adhere to religion and therefore believe in God. That's why I never consider Herzl to be a Jew. He was an atheist. But to me, when you say Jew, as a matter of fact, just anywhere in the world you say Jew, even if the people think incorrectly, they think about God's chosen people. But anytime you say the word Jew, somewhere God comes right next to it. So when someone says they're a Jew, but they're disassociated from God, I can no longer see the relationship.
I refer to my ancestors.
All right, but if people were Christians and no longer, they don't call themselves Christian people, they call themselves Christian religion. Judaism is a religion for us, not a people. The confusion arises. If this is the case, the first Jews in the world were Africans. Or if you don't say some of them were Africans, there's no question about this. These Jews belonged to states, Ethiopia, the oldest state in the world, and Egypt. Consequently, they did not become Jews because they were looking for a state. They had states, Ethiopia and Egypt.
What if they settled
lands
that were not
occupied? But that's not the case.
That's not what happened when the Jews went to Palestine.
No, that was not the case. Palestine was always occupied.
Even before the Jews came?
Yes, of course. Because out of Africa, it was out of Africa that they came into Palestine. Well, now, Arafat will give you a big argument on that one. Well, it's clearly that the Palestinians were there and that they were building up a national state.
Mm-hmm.
Judaism is a religion, Because even if the people were there before as Jews, before they took the religion, they didn't call themselves Jews. You understand it?
I'm not talking about the arrival.
No, I'm talking about way back. Before. Before Joseph was sold into Egypt as the... It's just going by the mythology. What were the people called before Joseph went down into Egypt? Were they called Jews? Before he went down? I think you'll need to look again. It was after this that they became to say Israel was their land, they were going to choose it. So it was out of Egypt that they came with the idea of Israel. So it's the coming out of here, and it's once the religion had taken its form, and it was able to take its form because of monotheism in Egypt. So it's out of Egypt that you find a Jewish religion, not a Jewish people, because in that case, you have, you know, even today, it's a derogatory term, but they call Ethiopian Jews Falashe. You've heard the term. Well, you know, these Falashe Jews existed for centuries. And where's their land? Is it not Ethiopia? So that's why I say Zionism, which is a national philosophy, which I accept as unjust, immoral, and atheist. That's not racist. That's not the argument. But it's this Zionism that tries to transform Judaism into a nationalism. And for me, Judaism is a religion, not a nationalism. For me, anybody can be a Jew. I don't know if they accept it, but I've been told from the time I was a child that Sammy Davis was converted to Judaism. And I assume that most Jews in America accepted Sammy Davis as a Jew. Now, I don't know, just because he comes a Jew now, he has a right to the land in Israel more than a Palestinian who was born there and has been kicked out. So that's where the trouble comes. That's why it's difficult for me to answer your question once it's posed in that manner. Oh, are there many? Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, just to name a few, Fannie Lou Hamer, Angela Davis, Assata Shaku, just to name a few. Oh, I'm sorry. How about Chetty Jagan? Of the PPP, we have a good alliance with Comrade Jagan, or the Progressive People's Party. What about Ewusi Kweyana? Sidney King, Ewusi Kweyana. George Lamming, is George Lamming born in Guyana? Lamming, is he born in Guyana?
I don't know. I don't know
Jagan is Lamming. We don't know Ewusi Kweyana?
No.
Well, he's now the head of the Workers' People Alliance, the organization of Wadney, and he's been around for an awful long time working and struggling there. You have Clive Thomas. Clive Thomas, I'm not sure if, let me remember correctly, I think it's still Raccoon is the name of his organization, and he is a writer, has written some, let me see, his last book I think was The Effect of Capitalist Economy and Third World Economies. Something on the more precise on the line of something like How Europe Underdeveloped Africa by Rodney. So there are some there. Mm-hmm. You could look at Ewusi Kweyana. You can get information from him by asking on the WPA, the Workers People's Alliance. He's now the head of it. I have the address, but not with me, but can give it to some of our people here who can pass it on to you. You're welcome. You know, this question of Islam is a question we must properly understand. You don't judge a people by the heights they achieve, but the depths from which they come. And when we come to judge Islam, we must understand when we're judging it from where it came, not from where it is. You know, Islam was prophesied by the Prophet Muhammad in Saudi Arabia, in Mecca. At the time, the Arabs were a nomadic people. As nomads, just scientifically speaking, women were a burden. Just scientifically speaking, nomads only bring as many women as they need, just reproduction, that's all. The culture and the, well, not the, yeah, it was the culture, the habit and the tradition of the day when the Prophet Muhammad was prophesizing the religion of Islam was that if a man and a woman had a child and the firstborn was a daughter, she was buried alive. It was only after they had a son that daughters could be born. This is a tradition. Of course, we know it's backward, but we must understand the material reality to which it was based. Nomadism. The Arabs were nomads. The Prophet Muhammad came to preach against all this. And you must imagine what the Prophet Muhammad, the burden he must have had, trying just to make it possible for there to be a firstborn woman without her being buried alive. This was the tradition which he came to fight against. So once you can begin to understand this, and you could know that the Prophet Muhammad and Islam took a uncompromising position against the oppression of women. Thus, if one would look properly, one would see it. The confusion sometimes arises because, as in all systems, especially in capitalist systems direct the people to judge the systems not by the principles of the systems, but by the adherence of the system. Thus, we are told that we should judge Christianity by Christians, we should judge socialism by socialists, and we should judge Islam by Muslims. But you never judge a system by its adherents, you judge it by its principles. When we come to judge Christianity, we can't really judge it by Christians. If we did, it should have been rooted out of the world centuries ago. When we come to judge socialism, we cannot judge it by the Soviet Union, or by Fidel Castro, or by Korea. We must judge it by its principles. Thus, when we come to judge Islam, we must judge it by its principles. And when you judge Islam by its principles, on the question of women, there's no question the Quran fights for the equality of women. Muslims may soil this, they may disrespect it, they may even try and use it as a means to oppress women. The slave master used Christianity as a means to oppress us. And some men will use Christianity as a means to oppress women. I remember even when my father used to laughingly tell my mother when they had arguments, "I wish I never gave up my rib for you." So it is a question of understanding that we don't judge Islam by Muslims, but by the Quran. And if you judge it by the Quran, there's no question here that it fights for the equality of women. Well, if you will look at the, I understand what the problem is. Karl Marx was a great man. And of course, Karl Marx did not invent socialism. He could not. Socialism is a truth and therefore cannot be invented by anyone, only observed. We call the laws of gravity, probably for a mnemonic device to help us pass tests, Newton's laws. But Newton cannot invent that a body falls at the rate of 32 feet per second squared, all Newton can do is observe this and properly record it. If I, knowing nothing of Newton, go in Timbuktu and do experiments with gravity, I will come to the exact same conclusion that Newton does, that a body falls at the rate of 32 feet per second squared. If I've never read Karl Marx, V.I. Lenin, or Frederick Engels, if I'm sitting in Timbuktu studying the relationship between capital and labor, I will come to the very same conclusions that Karl Marx came to. That until labor comes to dominate capital, capital will always exploit labor, creating inequalities in the society. This is an objective reality. One of Karl Marx's greatest contributions to us was in the arena of dialectics. It is here, really, that he came to really bring his creative energy. One of the things that Karl Marx showed us about dialectics was that everything has both positive and negative tendencies inside of it at all times. You agree to this statement? Thus, nationalism has both positive and negative characteristics. Under certain conditions, nationalism is negative. Under certain conditions, nationalism is positive. In Europe, where one went from a nation to a state structure, nationalism is reactionary and the use of it will lead to chauvinism. In Africa, where today we're going from state structures to nation, nationalism is a powerful force and properly used is a cohesive force for the nation so the state structure can have some reality. You understand what I'm saying? For example, in the island of Trinidad, where I was born, and when I was born I was a British subject because Britain colonized the island, when after struggle the British left the island and gave us independence, the independence which we inherited were state structures which British colonialism left for us. These state structures did not have a nation, Trinidad. As a matter of fact, it was far from the intention of British imperialism to make the people a cohesive force where they could easily struggle against British imperialism. Their job was to keep them fragmented as a nation. Keep the Indians fighting the Africans, keep the poor Africans against the rich Africans, the poor Indians against the rich Indians, etc., etc. Division everywhere. Women against men everywhere. So that once the state structure come, its job is to now come and form harmony, a national consensus that will give national unity to these state structures. Thus nationalism becomes a powerful force. In the question of Africa, African nationalism is a powerful force. As a matter of fact, we can see properly since World War II, the real battering ram against imperialism had been national liberation movements. The Vietnamese was a national liberation movement. The Palestine struggle is a national liberation movement. Frelimo, national liberation struggle. MPLA, national liberation struggle. As a matter of fact, you can show me the struggle of Fidel Castro was a national liberation struggle. You cannot show me anywhere since World War II where it has not been a national liberation struggle with guns in hand that have not been defeated imperialism. Thus, for us Africans who are going from a state structure to a nation, nationalism is a powerful weapon. And if we say we're going to unify Africa, and where we have a state structure, then you must understand the necessity of nationalism here. That's on one side. The results of it is clear. African workers are not oppressed only as workers, but are also oppressed because of their nationality, true or false. Thus, the Africans here have a double burden, which the white worker does not have. The white worker is oppressed as worker, not as a European. The African worker is oppressed as worker and as African. Thus, he has a double oppression here. He has a responsibility to speak to his culture. And thus he has a responsibility to reconstruct his culture, which has been trampled upon by imperialism. It is only he and he alone who is capable of doing this. Thus the need for national organizations are a result, number one, of the struggles in which we're involved in, the development of the forces, and the fact that it is a positive weapon in the arms of oppressed people who've been oppressed as a result of national oppression. This in no way does not mean that they're not in harmony with the interests of the workers. On the contrary, if you will look even in America, everywhere Africans have made advancements, the white workers have advanced, even in spite of their struggle against the African masses. And if you will look, the capitalists in this country always pit the white workers against us. We are never pitted against them. They always pit themselves against us. And wherever you look, you will see the white left is always fighting against nationalism. If you look at the Honorable Marcus Garvey, the Honorable Marcus Garvey had one of the biggest organized movements in the world. We would think everybody would be happy for this. His slogan was simple, Africa for the Africans, those at home and those abroad. But if we will look at the Universal Negro Improvement Association, his organization in America, you will see it was infiltrated by the FBI. As a matter of fact, Hoover was arrested by J. Edgar Hoover for political fraud, mail fraud, just like I arrested people in the 60s for fraud. At the same time, while the FBI infiltrated the UNIA, the Communist Party in America infiltrated Africans into the movement to cause trouble and to derail the ideology of the organization. Certainly the Communist Party cannot be proud of this history. Irrespective of what they say of Marcus Garvey, they cannot tell us the Honorable Marcus Garvey was in line and followed the policies of capitalism. He was a staunchly fighter against colonialism. And it was his threat to them that caused them to destroy his movement. Consequently, this understanding of nationalism had to be properly understood. The light of the events occurring in the Soviet Union today, we do not think that it's something that can be lightly dismissed, as others tried to dismiss in the past. One final reason. Every people must have their own ideology, and this ideology must come from the culture of the people. It is only the culture of the people that will energize the people to continue to struggle. Thus, the ideologies which we as Africans have must come from our own thinking. and thus it cannot reflect or mirror those of others. The role of nationalism in Europe will not be the same as it is in Africa, and should not expect it to be the same. Thus, African revolutionary organizations should in no way be expected to follow the dictates or the lines of development of European revolutionary organizations. These revolutionary organizations, while fighting for the same objective, socialism, can have differences in their ideologies and in the path they take to arrive at their socialism, although there can be no differences in their socialism, because its laws are universal and abiding. So the question is clear here. As a matter of fact, these nationalist struggles represent the interests of the working class throughout the world. Which working class man in America conscious cannot tell us that a liberated Vietnam is better for him? Which one cannot tell us that a liberated Tanzania, South Africa is better for workers all over the world, even though here it is a national liberation struggle? The division is usually imposed upon us by reactionary Marxist-Leninists, by those who are not Marxist-Leninists but seek to bring about confusion. Karl Marx said, "Workers of the world, unite." V.I. Lenin said, "Workers in all oppressed nationalities, unite." Lenin was only updating a reality that we today must continue. Louder, please. That's absolutely correct. And here, of course, we are proud to mention the name of that great fighter who picked up guns against them, Albizu Campos, in his struggle. You're absolutely correct. I'm sorry, it slipped out of my mind. Thank you for bringing it in and including it for us, especially since we need to be conscious of the struggle in Puerto Rico and to be sure that we come to support that struggle in every way, shape, and form. Two questions. The first question is, because one is leader, does it give you the right to decide what is just and the path of liberation for the masses? And the second question, how can you organize the masses if elitism exists among the leaders? The first question is, of course, you know what the answer is. There's no question here. Even if I didn't agree with you, I have to admit before the people that a leader doesn't have the right to decide himself. But the only reason why this is done for us more than for others is because we're not organized. And since we're not organized, we have leaders who become spokespeople who say anything they want first. Let me give you an example, not knocking anyone. I have never considered myself a leader, and I never will, because I consider that when you're a leader, you've got to have an organization. You know, that's what a leader means. If I'm a leader and I go to deal with America, I got to have an organization. I got to be able to go to the president and say, "Look here, my people say we want this. And if by tomorrow morning, 9 o'clock, we don't have it, we're putting 500,000 people in the streets in nonviolent demonstrations. That's all I got to do as a leader. I go home. Lay down, you understand? Tomorrow morning, you don't do it, 500,000 people in the street, even if I'm sleeping. You understand? Next day, I come to them and say, "Well, you know, our people asked you for this. You didn't give it to us. We put 500,000 people in the street nonviolently. We're still demanding it. Tomorrow, if we don't get it, we got to put 1 million people in the street with arms." And we put them, and I go sleep. So when you say you're a leader, you've got to have an organized force behind you. If you don't have an organized force, you're not a leader, and all you can do is go beg the white man. Whether you beg him for selling wolf tickets at first, "If you don't give it to us, we're going to burn the place down." He's going to burn the place down. Or else you're saying, "Well, you know, morally, you know to do better, you know you should do right." That's all it is. It falls between the two, either selling wolf tickets or trying to spray on the moral persuasion. So until there's an organized force, there is no leader. Secondly, organizing the people does not depend upon any one person, but on all of us. You must come to play your part in organizing the people. You must come to play your role in organizing the people. You have a contribution. All of us sitting here have a contribution and must make this contribution. If we do not make the contribution, then the one who's organizing people, it's clear, he who pays the piper calls the tune. So if there are elitist trends, then it is your responsibility. Because no leader is born. Martin Luther King was not born a leader, Jack. You understand? Nobody's been. Malcolm X certainly wasn't born a leader. He was a pimp. He was a criminal. It is conditions and consciousness that make us come to recognize what our responsibility is to the masses of our people. That's all it takes. So no one is born a leader. So if you see people organizing, you have the right to organize just like everyone else. You have a contribution to make. And if it's a leaderist organization, all the more reason why you must make a contribution so proper organizing is done. To organize the people, to want to make a contribution to people, all you have to do is to love your people. That's all. The only difference between Martin Luther King and you and I is that he loved us more than we love us. That's all. And nobody here has to be taught how to love. But everybody here knows that nobody loves our people. Nobody. And it's clearly manifested by the conditions in which our people find themselves. Because if we loved our people, all of us would be so busy doing something about the conditions wouldn't exist. It's as simple as that. So all you have to do is to love your people more than the elitist leader who loves the people, because the elitist leader doesn't love the people. He's only using the people for his own opportunistic reasons. You come now genuine with love and organize the people and out organize the elitist leaders. No more questions? Exactly. The question is, what is scientific socialism? Anytime you have more than two people, you have an economic system because you have an exchange of goods and services. There are only two economic systems in the world, just two. Capitalism or socialism leading to communism. We have pointed out, and it's a fact, there is no communist country in the world. There are socialist countries which want to become communist, which tell us they're building communism. And certainly the example of the Soviet Union, which we used in the beginning, is clear. We said there are only two economic systems, capitalism or socialism, and there can only be two. Because every economic system must answer one fundamental question. Who will own and control the wealth of the country? Who will own and control the means of production? The question can only be answered two ways. Either a few will own or all will own. It's as simple as that. It's as simple as that. In a capitalist system, a few people own. In a socialist system, the people own and control the wealth of the country and have the right to distribute it based on need in the society. America is a clear example of this backward capitalist system. We say it is more ripe for revolution today than it was in the 60s, and it's clear. In America today, there exists over 3 million homeless. In the 1960s, they were not there. As a matter of fact, in the 1960s, it was capable for someone to be born in America in a little village somewhere, grow up and never see a homeless person. But today, that is not possible. In every village in America, there exist homeless people. And every man and woman in America, even the most unconscious, is aware of the fact that America is capable of feeding the 3 million homeless without feeling a dent in its pocketbook. So the objective conditions with the rising will is there for it. When we see the homeless, those of us who are touched by it, understand we have a responsibility. The only way we can feel at ease is if we know we're working to change the system. But if we're not doing anything to change the system and we see the homeless, all we can do is feel sorry for them and tra-la-la-la. But once you're working consciously, and the more homeless you see, the harder you work to bring down this vicious system, if that is your inclination, if even your inclination is to get the homeless out the street and put them in shelter, the more homeless you see, the harder you work to do this. You understand what I'm saying? So we're not just saying it has to be revolutionary work, but some work to alleviate the sufferings of the people. Under a socialist system, the people own and control the wealth of the country. So consequently, in a socialist country, there can be no accumulation of wealth legally. Legally. Illegally, of course, it can be done. And then when it's done and the people are caught, the measures are properly taken against them. But in America, it is legally possible for you to be filthy rich in New York City and have the homeless sleeping all around the bottom of your house. It's a legal possibility. In socialism, it cannot exist. So these are the difference between the two systems. Who owns the wealth of the society and who has the right to distribute it? In a capitalist system, the few do. In a socialist system, it must be done by the people through organized form. Of course, there are more differences to it. I want to make that clear to you. This is a fundamental difference. But it is not my purpose to come and tell you and teach you capitalism and socialism. My purpose is to stimulate you to want to know for yourself. Because once you know for yourself what it is, you will be a determined fighter based on your own understanding. If you come to grasp it only from what I say, when you face contradictions, you will run and say, oh, Brother Kwame, I'm here to tell me what to do. But once you have it for yourself, you will go straight ahead. If there are no more questions, then our last statement to you is clear. Humanity all over the world today is suffering. The only way that this humanity will rid itself of its suffering is through conscious organization of all of humanity. Conscious organization of all of humanity. Africans throughout the world represent the most disorganized force in the world. But it's a dialectical world. Wherever we are the last behind, we can catch up quickly with others because we're so far behind. We must come quickly to give to the world the example of the